public. I heard this was a suicide,
Ian said.
It would be a mistake for them to handle the case as anything other than a homicide,
Ben said.
As a professional law enforcement agency, they shouldn't assume any death is a suicide or a natural death. Not unless they want to risk losing crucial evidence.
So you're not a suspect?
No,
Ben said confidently.
I'm sure they want to talk to me and other parents in hopes of getting information that could be pertinent to the crime.
On the one hand, it's a shame we have to spend resources investigating a guy like that.
And on the other hand?
Ben asked.
Pay attention to what's going on when you're there. We might have a big story on our hands.
I'll keep you updated.
Ben hung up, shaking his head at the notion that Ian was more worried about getting the story than the fact that Ben was being sucked into their investigation. Ben reached his van without further interruption and climbed inside. He had a few hours before he needed to meet with investigators, and he planned to make good use of his time. 30. Colin walked at a clipped pace down the hallway that ran through the center of the police department and entered one of the conference rooms. He'd just been on the phone with Peyton White's neighbor, an elderly woman who happened to know a lot about the comings and goings of the White family. The last to arrive, Colin shut the door. He took a seat at the rectangular table next to Ren Howe and across from Gretchen Sullivan, the woman who apparently had invited neighbors in Roger Willis's area over to talk about Roger. The room was small, sparsely decorated with a black and white framed poster of the Tower Bridge. A one-way mirror took up half of one of the walls. At the moment, nobody was on the other side.
"I have things to do," Gretchen Sullivan said. "Can we get started?"
"Sure,"
Colin said as he grabbed a pad of paper from a stack of notebooks sitting on the table.
"We'd like to know about the meeting you held at your house recently."
"Really? Oh my God, is that what this is about?"
Colin nodded.
"We were told that a group of people had gathered to talk about how they could get rid of Roger Willis."
"We gathered at my house to talk about bullying." Later on, the conversation turned to the child molester, I mean Willis, of course, and how we might be able to keep our children safe from him.
"Let me reword the question,"
Colin said.
"Did you or anyone else in the room discuss ways to possibly rid the neighborhood of Roger Willis?"
She rolled her eyes.
"Nobody discussed hiring a hitman, if that's what you mean."
Her brow puckered.
"If you people are going to try to use word trickery to get me to say something I shouldn't, maybe I do need to call a lawyer."
Ren sighed.
"That's your call, ma'am."
"Ma'am,"
she chuckled.
"I was assured I was not a person of interest and that there was no reason to bother calling my lawyer. They said you just had a few questions. But now I don't know. I don't like the vibe I'm getting in this cramped little space."
"This is not an interrogation,"
Colin told her.
"It's just an interview."
She glanced at her watch.
Nobody said one word about getting rid of Roger Willis. It was more about keeping our eyes wide open and making sure he didn't set foot on school grounds.
She looked at Ren.
"Do you have kids?"
He shook his head.
"How about you?"
she asked Colin.
"I have a daughter."
"Roger Willis was sitting in his car a few feet away from where our girls were playing soccer,"
she went on, her voice scolding.
"After everything that happened, the man was sitting right there in plain view as if he didn't have a care in the world. Let that soak in for a minute."
Colin and Ren waited her out. Her face reddened.
"We, the group of parents at my house, had recently been made aware that other victims accusing Mr. Willis of sexual abuse had come forward. I called the meeting because I wanted everyone in the neighborhood to know what we were dealing with."
She jabbed a finger at the table every time she made a point.
"If the soccer coach had made a move on one of your daughter's teammates," she said point blank to Colin, "I bet you would have wanted to make sure everyone in the community was aware that the creep was on the loose."
Again, Colin remained silent.
"Who was at the meeting?"
Ren asked. She exhaled.
"Let's see. Sunil Rajan, Earl Laredo, Max DaCosta, Ruby Safford, Marley Mogelson, and her husband, Peter."
"What about Peyton White?"
Colin asked. She shook her head.
Peyton was the one who gave Roger Willis a piece of his mind in the parking lot outside of the indoor soccer facility.
Were you there?
No, but I wish I had been.
Why is that? Ren asked.
She shrugged, looked him squarely in the eye, and said, No reason.
Ren asked,
Was Ben Morrison the one who pulled Peyton White off Roger Willis?
That's what I heard. Colin read over his notes.
You didn't mention Ben Morrison as one of the people at your house on the night of the parent.
My bad, she said. Ben was there. So was his wife, Melanie. But they left early.
Do you know why?
Not really. I think Ben was worried we were all jeopardizing the upcoming case against Roger Willis, especially after the altercation between Peyton White and Willis in the parking lot.
Where were you Sunday morning between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m.?
I'm a single mother raising two daughters. I was asleep.
Anything else you would like to tell us?
She presented them with a tight-lipped smile. She nodded.
I'm glad he's dead.
Roger Willis? Ren asked.
Yes.
10 seconds after Gretchen Sullivan left, a uniformed officer entered the room to let them know that Peyton White had arrived with a criminal lawyer in tow. The interview with Peyton White went much differently than the one with Gretchen Sullivan. Peyton's answers to their questions were vague, if he answered at all.
How good of friends were you with Roger Willis?
Ren asked.
He was my daughter's soccer coach. I think that says it all. Not really,
Colin cut in.
Did you ever spend time with him and his wife, Sharon, outside of soccer practices and games?
He shrugged.
Sure, yeah. We spent a day or two on the weekend by their pool. With Roger, Sharon, and their kids?
Colin continued.
Yes. Did you know Roger's daily routine?
I didn't know he had a routine.
His hobbies?
Colin provided.
What he enjoyed doing in his free time? I have no idea.
Ren cut in.
Didn't you and Roger run a marathon together?
Peyton scoffed.
It was a half marathon. That was nearly 2 years ago. But you knew he enjoyed running,
Colin said.
What about kayaking? Did you ever go kayaking with him? No. But you were aware of the fact that he enjoyed the sport.
Sure.
I think it would be safe to say he enjoyed many sports. Unlike Roger, I didn't have the luxury of time.
What do you do? Ren asked.
I'm an investment banker. I work long hours, including many weekends. What about yesterday?
Colin asked.
What about it? Can you tell us where you were between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. on Sunday? I was asleep. Were your wife and kids home? Of course, they were. This interview is done,
Peyton's lawyer said before Peyton could finish answering. The lawyer stood. Peyton followed suit. Colin thanked Peyton for his cooperation. After the door clicked shut, he looked at Ren and said,
He just lied. His wife and kids were in Lake Tahoe. How do you know?
Ren asked.
I left business cards at the homes of neighbors we were unable to catch at home. Peyton's wife called me before our meeting. I want to get a warrant to search his home.
31. Both Lacey and Jason had spent endless hours either banging nails on the vent cover or looking for a place where the key might go. Although Jason had consumed more than his share of food and water, they both knew she would give in and share her rations. She'd calculated that they would get 2 inches of water each for the next 3 days. They both had 1 more inch of water left for the day. She didn't trust Jason to take only his share, so she poured his ration into an empty bottle and gave it to him that way. When nighttime came, the place grew dark, almost as dark as it had been when they were buried in the box. But she could still see shadows, depending on which way she looked.
Don't you think we should talk about the people who may have had grievances with you or your company?
My enemies?
Yes.
What's the point? We're here, aren't we? Knowing who did this to us isn't going to save the day.
If we know what we're dealing with, maybe that will help us figure a way out of here. There's nothing else to do. Humor me.
The list is long.
She frowned.
I'm serious.
So am I.
Did you get in a fight with one of your friends?
I don't have many friends, Lacey. I'm talking about work.
She tried to recall the last time they'd talked about his work. Whenever she asked him about his day, he said everything was fine. Rinse and repeat.
I don't understand, she went on. I thought your employees and clients respected you.
It's not a big deal. It's business. Sometimes you have to trounce the competition to stay in the game.
She wasn't sure why she was surprised, but she was.
Give me an example.
Last summer, rumor had it that one of my main competitors was having a tough time. So I quickly announced that I was hiring and that new employees would receive a $2,000 bonus if they agreed to stay on for at least 1 year. That's what you call kicking a rival while he's down.
So the other guy's employees came to work for you?
Yes.
That's horrible.
No, Lacey, use your brain. It's business. And it worked out better than expected. With so many experienced laborers, no other builder could match our productivity and quality of work. Earnings skyrocketed.
You said we were broke.
Did I say that?
Yes.
Well, we did agree to keep our money separate, didn't we?
I see. So I was broke, but you've been doing pretty well for yourself.
Here we go. This is why we can't have a conversation.
Why is that?
Because somehow I always end up being the bad guy.
Another lie, she thought. If anything, she always pumped him up and told him how wonderful he was. If he talked badly about himself, she told him he was talking nonsense.
So what did your competition do? The company that lost their workers?
They folded. They no longer exist.
What about the employees who didn't take you up on your offer? What happened to them?
All that was left were the ones either making too much money or were too old. If I worried about every employee, it would defeat the purpose of trouncing the competition.
Lacey wasn't sure why she was shocked, but she was. She'd always known Jason was decisive and strong-minded, and sometimes unwilling to compromise when it came to his business. But she'd also thought he had integrity. A heaviness settled within her, tightening her chest, reminding her of that awful time in her life when she realized her mother had married the devil. She'd felt lost and helpless. But everything had changed when she ran away to California, and again when she met Jason. She had begun to think of her time with her stepfather as an event in her life that had served her well, since it made her appreciate the little things in life. After she'd run away and started a new life, she'd worked hard to wipe out all those incredibly horrific memories. She'd done it with kindness and optimism. She'd chosen positivity over negativity and happiness over sadness. She'd read a lot of self-help books over the years. It never hurt to be reminded that life was precious, every day a miracle to be cherished, and every person walking this earth had a sliver of good inside of them. What a fucking crock of shit.
Listen,
Jason said, breaking into her realization that life was hard and had a way of fucking you over when you least expected it.
The men who play softball when it comes to business may look good in the press, and they may even show an uptick in earnings for a year or two, but it won't last because they aren't winners. They're losers. Instead of running around playing the game, they're standing on the sidelines watching. And when their business tanks, they get that deer in the headlights expression and wonder what the hell happened.
He was right. His list of enemies must be very long, she realized. Lacey was more certain than ever that she might die a slow and horrible death, all because she had chosen to marry an asshole. Maybe the biggest asshole in the history of the universe. 32. Jesse was asked to have a seat while the receptionist went to find her manager, Greg Fisher, second in charge at JHG, since Jason Geiger was out of the office. The building was impressive. There were lots of windows and gleaming marble floors. Jason Geiger appeared to have made quite a name for himself. His company was responsible for developing more than 20 community shopping centers. Greg Fisher approached a few minutes later. He was 6 feet tall with a lean body, sandy-colored hair, and a deeply dimpled chin. He shook Jesse's hand.
I was told you were looking for Jason Geiger.
That's right. I'm a private investigator. His wife, Lacey, is the person I've been hired to locate, but it appears neither Jason nor Lacey have been home in over a week.
Do you mind my asking why you're looking for Lacey?
Her grandmother passed away and left her a gift. He nodded.
Jesse glanced around.
Do you think we could talk in a private setting?
Sure, follow me.
Once they were in his office, he gestured for Jesse to take a seat in front of his desk. While he settled in, she took a few seconds to admire his office. A large mahogany desk, plush carpeting, and floor-to-ceiling windows. Once Greg was seated, she got right to business.
The inheritance Lacey is set to receive requires my finding her in a matter of weeks. That's why I'm here, and that's why I need to be frank. I need to know if you or anyone in this building might know where Jason and Lacey could be.
He rubbed his chin in a thoughtful manner.
As the president of JHG, Jason's absence has been a concern.
Jesse was surprised by his statement. Although the Geiger's neighbor and the people Lacey worked with hadn't seen Lacey in days, Jesse kept thinking there would be a simple explanation for their leaving the city and that the search would end here.
So you don't know where he is?
Greg Fisher looked toward the door as if to make sure he wouldn't be overheard.
He has had a habit of coming and going as he pleases. As far as I know, no one in this building is aware of Jason's sudden disappearance. Most of the people around here have been easily placated when I tell them he'll be back next week.
When do you plan on telling them the truth?
I can't answer that, because I don't know what the truth is. I, too, drove by their house and knocked on the door, but, as you said, nobody was home.
Have you called the police? He shook his head.
Word would have gotten out quick. I decided it was too early to worry project managers.
A friend of mine, a detective at the Sacramento PD, Jesse told him, was able to gain access into the Geiger's house. He said there was no evidence of foul play. The Geiger's neighbor has been collecting their mail. The last time the neighbor saw Lacey and Jason was Friday night before they drove off. Did Jason mention anything about going out to dinner for his anniversary?
Another shake of the head.
He rarely talks to me about his home life.
Jesse knew she might be overstepping an invisible line in the sand, but she wanted to keep Greg Fisher talking, hopeful he would recall some little tidbit that might give her a clue to help find Lacey.
I've done some research, Jesse said, keeping her voice low. And I could be wrong, but I've gotten the impression, based on complaints and lawsuits against Jason Geiger, that the president of JHG is not well-liked.
Greg tugged at his tie.
That would be putting it mildly.
Can you elaborate?
I shouldn't, but since we're being frank, let me sum the man up for you.
Greg leaned forward and said,
Jason Geiger is not a good businessman or leader. He lacks empathy and has zero integrity, taking credit for my work and others and placing blame where it doesn't belong. Because he doesn't know how to empower others, he is unable to engender loyalty. He is a narcissist, and that, Jesse Cole, is just the beginning.
Jesse nodded. Chills skittered up her back as she reached into her purse for her notebook. The man was angry. His jaw had visibly hardened and his body tensed when he talked about Jason. She slid her notebook across the desk so Greg could look over a list of names she'd compiled.
What is this?
I put together the names of companies and individuals Jason has sued over the years. I was hoping you could put a star or make a note in the margin next to any company or person you think might be holding a grudge against Jason.
He chuckled. The tension had left his shoulders.
I take it you don't think Lacey and Jason are off sipping Mai Tais in the Bahamas?
No, she said. I don't believe that, not after speaking with Jason's mother.
Ah, she's lovely, isn't she?
His sarcasm was thick.
It sounds as if maybe your name should be added to the list, Jesse said.
His gaze fell to the paper she'd handed him.
Maybe so.
Why are you still working for the man?
That's a good question. Quite honestly, I was going to turn in my resignation on Monday. But Jason was a no-show, and here I was, the only employee at JHG with authority to sign important documents, including paychecks, to keep the gears turning. There are budgets and schedules to be made, shopping centers being built as we speak, tenants that need guidance, and day-to-day fires to be put out. I couldn't just walk out and leave Sally, Kim, Gary, and all the others to fend for themselves.
Jesse and Greg Fisher spent the next 30 minutes narrowing her list to the top 5 people who might have it in for Jason Geiger. By the time Jesse left the building, she knew more about Jason Geiger than she cared to know. He wasn't just a bad boss. He was an awful human being who held no regard for others. She also had one more name to put on her list. Greg Fisher. There was something about his carefully controlled tone and the way he hid his hands whenever he started to get twitchy that made her take notice. 33. Z and Toby had been sitting in Z's car across the street from Dorothy and Alice's house since 8 a.m. It was almost 10 a.m. Toby had the day off and had agreed to come with her. She figured he must not have any idea what he was getting himself into. Sitting in a car all day could get tedious quickly. She'd spent the first hour explaining what she did and how the Jesse Cole agency specialized in finding missing persons, including runaway teenagers and old friends their clients had lost touch with, or helping an individual search for their birth parents. Search engines and databases, some free and some paid for, were just the beginning of the process. The next was contacting anyone who might be able to give them another piece of the puzzle. In a way, they were in the information business, she'd told him. The last 15 minutes had been filled with an awkward silence, so she decided to find out more about him by asking him a list of truth or dare questions she'd found on the internet. "Have you had a girlfriend before?" she blurted. Toby squirmed uncomfortably in his seat.
"Of course."
"How many?"
"I don't know. 3, maybe 4.
"He's too experienced for you. Get rid of him." "Stop it," Z told the voices. "Leave us alone." Toby frowned.
"Excuse me?"
"Sorry, I told you about the voices, didn't I? Mary and Lucy and Francis. I'm pretty much a 4 for the price of 1 kind of deal." She laughed. He didn't. "Have you ever been cheated on?" she asked next.
"Not that I know of."
"Impressive. What is the most expensive thing you've ever stolen?" This time he looked at her as if she'd lost her marbles, which, of course, she had.
"I've never stolen anything. Why would I? Have you?"
"No," she lied. "Never. I was just testing you." He seemed much different from the guy who served her tea at the coffee shop. Much more confident. The silence hung in the air again. She couldn't handle it. "Who here would you most like to make out with?" she asked.
"You're the only person in the car,"
he pointed out with a smile. "So that means me, right?" His smile turned into a wide grin.
"Do you want me to kiss you?"
he finally asked.
"Is that what this is all about?"
"Sort of. I mean, I am on the job and everything, but even if we happened to kiss, I could still see out of the corner of my eye if someone left the house." She gestured across the street. "I mean, the house we're watching is right there." She was ready to pucker up, but suddenly Toby had questions of his own.
"What are you going to do if someone walks out that door?" he asked.
"Well," she said, "I'm really hoping they both leave because I want to sneak inside and have a look around."
"Isn't that illegal?"
"I don't know." Another lie. "Maybe. Probably. But definitely not if nobody finds out."
"I don't think you should risk breaking and entering."
"How else am I going to find out for sure if their daughter is alive?"
"What helpful information do you think you'd find inside the house?"
She shrugged. "I don't know. An address in their contact book?"
"If they've kept quiet about her being alive all these years, do you really think they would put their daughter's name and address right with all their other contacts?"
"Point taken," she said. "He's such a downer. Dump his ass." "Not yet," Z thought. There was something about Toby that made her insides do funny things. Besides, he hadn't kissed her yet. "Are you going to kiss me or not?" she asked, sounding more exasperated than intended. He leaned forward and brushed his lips over hers. Much too soon, he pulled back to look at her. Bummer. That was it? It was over before she had any time at all to figure out if she liked the kiss or had a chance to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. But she quickly realized he wasn't finished when he leaned forward and kissed her again. This kiss was firmer, deeper, longer, better. She melted into him, and for the first time in forever, the voices in her head appeared to have been rendered speechless. 34. Ben walked through the littered alleyway where John Eberling had been found strangled to death 12 years ago. Not much noise came from the apartments on both sides. Traffic hummed nearby. He half expected to experience flashbacks after having one while talking to Renee Walker, but nothing happened. Ben picked up some trash and tossed it into the dumpster. Renee had thought it odd that Ben hadn't mentioned his altercation with John Eberling in the write-up he'd done at the time. Ben agreed. She thought he'd done so to protect her privacy. He might not remember much before his accident, but he'd read enough of his notes and old write-ups to know that he'd never been the kind of reporter to leave out such an important detail. Ian had told him many times over the years that Ben was known for his hardcore, tell-it-like-it-is reporting. So, why hadn't he stated that John Eberling was responsible for putting his own girlfriend in the hospital? 39 stitches, broken cheek, fractured skull, bleeding from her ears. Jesus. Ben's jaw hardened and his fingers curled into fists. He looked down at his hands and forced them to relax. He took a breath. Had he dealt with the problem himself after John killed his mother's beloved cat and nearly killed Renee? The only reason Ben could think of for omitting such an important detail would have been if he'd had something to hide. The thought caused his insides to tumble around like sopping wet clothes in a dryer. He glanced at his watch. He still had time before his scheduled meeting with Detective Grayson and Ren Howe. He was hungry. He climbed into his van and drove to a nearby coffee shop. He ordered soup, a sandwich, and water, found a table, and opened the file from 12 years ago. This time he read every word, starting with the police report and ending with the piece he'd written for the Tribune. Apparently, heroin had been found in John's pocket. The police had been quick to surmise that John's death was a drug deal gone bad, never mind that the autopsy revealed no signs of drugs in his system. Ben had used drugs as the theme for the article he'd written back then, meticulously showing how heroin got into the state via a sophisticated distribution system that allowed the criminals to deliver the drug as if it were pizza. His food was brought to the table. He ate while he read. Just as Renee Walker had pointed out, there was nothing in the article he'd written about her having a relationship with John. Ben had stated that John didn't have any enemies. Friends and co-workers claimed that John Eberling had a temper, but overall, he was an okay guy. It was noted on the police report, "Also found in the victim's pocket was a diamond ring, most likely a wedding ring." That specific footnote gave Ben pause. He pulled out the notes he'd taken when he'd recently spoke to Gina Eberling, John's mother. Just as he'd thought. She had told Ben, stated clearly, in fact, that the intruder had taken her wedding ring, left on the counter next to the sink. Ben searched through the papers at the back of the file, which included the interview he'd done with Gina 12 years ago. No mention of her wedding ring being stolen. At the time, she referred to the intruder as a young man. If she hadn't been able to see his face due to a black mask, how would Gina have known if he was young or old? She must have recognized something about the intruder and realized it might be her son. A certain mannerism? Or maybe she hadn't known for sure until John Eberling was found strangled and left in a dumpster with her wedding ring in his pocket. That's when she knew without a doubt that it was her son who had broken into her house and killed her beloved cat, Harry. When Gina was called down to the morgue to identify her son, she never claimed the ring, and she never told the police or Ben what she knew. Why? Because, despite what John had done, he was her son, and she didn't want anyone to know he'd killed her beloved pet. Maybe she hadn't believed it herself. 35. Again. Colin was the last one to enter the conference room where interviews were being conducted at the station. Ren Howe and Ben Morrison were already seated.
"Thank you for coming in,"
Colin said to Ben. Ben nodded.
"Can we get you anything?"
"No, thanks. I just ate."
Colin gestured at Ben's hand.
"Hurt yourself?"
Ben held his gaze.
"Broken glass in the garbage. Just a scratch. As you know, we have a few questions we'd like to ask you about Roger Willis."
Another nod.
How well would you say you knew Roger Willis?
Well enough to know I didn't like him.
You attacked him on the field after a soccer game, is that right?
I grabbed his arm. He fell over. I wouldn't call it an attack.
Fair enough. Why did you grab his arm?
I didn't like the way he was touching my daughter. He had his hand firmly planted on the back of her neck, and he was rubbing his thumb back and forth in what I consider to be an inappropriate manner.
Colin would have done the same thing, but he kept that thought to himself.
So you never attended any functions with Roger Willis outside of soccer?
Not a chance in hell.
Colin glanced at the notes he'd brought with him.
It says here that your daughter was good friends with Roger's daughter, Paige.
I believe they were close.
Did you ever drop her off at Roger's house?
Never.
Quite frankly, my wife and I didn't see eye to eye when it came to Roger Willis. If it had been up to me, my daughter wouldn't have been allowed to go to the Willis's home.
I guess it would be safe for me to assume that your wife was surprised to learn about his arrest?
Definitely. She still feels guilty.
Why would she feel guilty?
For allowing Abigail to spend time at the Willis's house. She trusted Roger. She trusted his wife, too. Sharon.
Ben nodded.
Sharon seems to think there are a few of you who held a grudge against Roger.
I already told you I didn't like him.
Sharon believes you and other parents would do whatever you must to make sure Roger Willis was never allowed near your daughters again.
I'm not sure what you're implying.
Something told him that Ben knew exactly what he was implying. Colin scratched his forehead.
Never mind,
he said.
Let's move on. Did you attend a meeting held by Gretchen Sullivan?
Yes. My wife and I were invited to her house to talk about bullying. As soon as the discussion turned to Roger Willis, we left.
Why is that?
Because I wanted Roger Willis to be locked up for life. And damned if I was going to be a part of anything that might jeopardize that from happening.
You believe in the justice system?
I do.
Ben Morrison was difficult to read. Colin wasn't sure if Ben was trying to purposefully suppress his emotions, or if he was simply indifferent to what had happened to Roger Willis. Colin looked at Wren.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Morrison?
Wren cleared his throat.
Do you mind telling us where you were between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. on Sunday?
My alarm went off at 6 a.m. I made coffee, ate some breakfast, then went to pick up a file I had left on my desk at work. After chatting with my boss, Ian Savage, I met my wife at 8 in Rockland to watch Abigail play soccer.
You and your wife didn't drive to the game together?
No.
Your boss works on the weekends?
More often than not.
Colin made a note, then looked at Ben.
What did the two of you talk about?
Ben shrugged.
I don't recall. Weather, family, small talk.
Is there anything you would like to add?
Colin asked.
As a matter of fact, there is.
Ben said.
What makes you think this wasn't a suicide?
Wren shifted in his seat. Colin smiled.
We're not saying it is or it isn't.
Ben had his own pad of paper and pen sitting neatly on the table in front of him. He kept making notes as if he were the one doing the interviewing.
I saw Peyton White in the parking lot as I was coming in,
Ben noted.
Who else have you talked to?
Wren cleared his throat. Colin stood.
I think our interview is over.
36. The short and explosive shrieks pierced her ears, bringing Lacey awake and to her feet so fast she bumped her head against the cement ceiling above. She saw stars and felt an intense stab of pain pierce her skull. She put both her hands to her head. Fuck! What the hell was going on? Thin lines of daylight coming through the slits in the vent made it possible for her to see Jason inside the dirt box, dancing around like a madman. If he could stop screaming and hold still, she might be able to figure out what was going on. She looked around and spotted two wrappers, torn bits of paper, and a tin can that was a little bigger than a pack of cigarettes. It took a closer look to see that he was covered in red ants. "Take off your shirt," she told him, "and use it to wipe them off you." It took forever for Jason to listen to what she was saying. Finally, he removed his shirt and used it to swat the ants as he hopped up and down. He tossed the shirt her way. Lacey picked up her shoe, which was turning out to be a very useful tool, and smashed the ants that had fallen to the ground with it before shaking out the shirt so she could help slap the insects off him. By the time all was said and done, Jason had stripped naked. It took a good 30 minutes to remove all the ants, and another 20 to pick them out of his hair. After eliminating every last ant, she shook out his clothes and tossed them to him. The tin container, she noticed, had a lock on it. The key was gone, but she knew he'd used it to open the box. He must have been surprised to see all those ants. Karma could be a real bitch, since she was sure he'd thought there must be food inside, and chances were good he hadn't planned on sharing. She grabbed one of the wrappers that she'd spotted earlier and held it up so Jason could see it. "This looks like a candy wrapper," her stomach grumbled. Preoccupied with his wounds, Jason wouldn't make eye contact. "After I gave you most of my food and water, you found 2 candy bars and ate them both?"
"I found them a few days ago and hid them. I was going to share them with you, but then you found another bag."
"Stop," she said, throwing her arms wide. "I don't want to hear it. I don't care."
"I think I know who built this place,"
he said after a bit of awkward silence. She said nothing. She no longer cared about his enemies or who had done this to them. He'd been right all along. What good would it do them knowing the name of the person who had abducted them? Would it help them find a way out? The answer was no. Dropping the wrapper, shoulders slumped, she grabbed the shoe and went to work on the remaining nails. She wanted to get the hell out of here. He shut his laptop and fell back, laughing. The red ants had been genius. Watching the big and mighty president of JHG scream like a fucking hyena and dance like a clown was more enjoyable than he'd thought possible. The only thing that would have been better is if he'd come down hard on a nail and ended up with an infection. He raked a hand through his hair as he collected himself. His gaze fell on a wedding picture of him and his wife. When they'd first married, they had talked about having kids someday. Now she was gone. Crazy, when he thought about it, because his wife was the only one who had tried to warn him about Jason Geiger. It only took one quick introduction for her to say she had a bad feeling about Geiger. She'd told him to walk away, but he hadn't listened to her. And it was too late to do anything about it now. All because of one asshole named Jason Geiger. 37. Jesse spent most of Monday evening researching the top 5 people on the list she had titled Jason Geiger's Enemies. It was Tuesday morning. She was in her car, driving east toward Elk Grove. She felt more determined than ever to find Lacey. She felt a strange bond with the woman who had run away at such a young age, changed her name, and somehow managed to make a new life for herself. It broke Jesse's heart to think of Anne/Lacey cuffed and chained to her bed. Meeting her biological mother and seeing the place where she'd been held captive had made Jesse sick to her stomach. She would find Lacey and see that she got the inheritance she had coming to her. Jesse was also curious to know if Lacey was happy. Did she have any idea that her husband was seeing another woman? Did she know Jason Geiger had a list of enemies a mile long? So many questions. She needed more time. Jesse had been looking for missing persons long enough to know it wouldn't do any good to file a police report. Not unless the person or people missing were considered vulnerable. That would include the elderly, a child under the age of 13, or someone suffering from a mental or physical condition. A victim of a crime would also cause the police to take immediate action, but she had no proof that either Lacey or Jason were in danger. Bottom line, people over the age of 18 had no legal obligation to return home. Brody Hoffman was the first person on her list of Jason's enemies. Brody's company, Hoffman Construction, went belly up after JHD Properties sued Hoffman Construction for breach of contract, stating that the contractor had done work of unacceptably poor quality. Brody Hoffman lived on what looked like a deserted farm in Elk Grove. The single-story ranch house sat front and center on the property. As she walked to the door, she stopped to listen. No dogs barking or pigs grunting. Just a faint whistling sound as the wind blew through tall rows of corn. In the far distance, she saw cows grazing in the fields surrounding the house. She knocked on the door, waited, knocked again. She was about to walk around the side of the house to see if someone might be working in the back when the door opened. She knew from the research she'd done that he was 46 years old. He looked closer to 56. He was short and on the stocky side. His hair was gray. Two deep lines made twin rivers between narrow eyes.
Are you Brody Hoffman?
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Jesse Cole. I'm a private investigator looking for Jason Geiger. He shook his head.
Name doesn't ring any bells.
Jason Geiger owns JHG Properties. His company sued Hoffman Construction 5 years ago.
Ah, JHG Properties. Now that definitely rings a bell or two.
I thought it might. She tried to look over his shoulder into his house. If I'm not interrupting anything, I was hoping I could come in and ask you a few questions. He hesitated. It won't take long, I promise. Reluctantly, he allowed her inside. As she followed him toward the back of the house, she reached into her purse and turned on the recorder she'd put in the front pocket. He brought her to the kitchen. The Formica counters had seen better days. The sink was filled with dirty dishes. He took a seat at a small, deeply scarred wooden table in the kitchen nook and gestured for her to do the same. He didn't offer her anything to drink, just crossed his arms, making it clear she needed to get on with it. Jessie pulled out her notebook, skimmed the first page, and said, "It looks like the trial between your company and JHG went on for months."
"It did."
Jessie read on. "The jury agreed with JHG, and it cost you a lot of time and money."
"I'll save you some time. I lost everything. My business, my home in Sacramento, my respect, and my dignity. My wife left me too. It was all too much for her. But my story probably ends better than most."
He gestured through the window toward the fields she'd seen earlier. Beyond the cornfields, she saw a tractor and a backhoe.
"I found this place for cheap," he told her. 50 acres with hilltop views and lots of small ponds. The cattle keep the roof over my head and food on the table. The equipment out there is what's left over from when I was running Hoffman Construction. I rent it out for a good price, and that keeps the utilities paid."
"Are the cattle used for beef?" she asked, mostly to put him at ease.
"Oh, no. The cattle don't belong to me. I get paid to let them graze. It's a win-win since having them on my land makes for a healthier pasture if I ever decide to grow corn or alfalfa."
While Jessie wrote in her notepad, he asked,
"Why are you here?"
She flipped to the next page of her notepad, purposefully displaying the list of names she'd been compiling in hopes of getting a reaction. "Jason and his wife have been missing for a week now, and..."
"Yeah, so?"
he asked, cutting her off. Leaning forward, he took a closer look at the names. He snorted.
"Looks to me like you have a long list of people with grievances against Jason Geiger."
"Does that surprise you?"
"Do I look surprised?"
"No."
"You're grasping for straws, lady."
Her cheeks warmed.
"I don't mean to be rude,"
he said.
"But do you really think I, or any of these people on your list, would tell you if they did something to Jason Geiger?"
That was a very good question, one she didn't plan on answering honestly. 50% of the work she did included talking to people, getting into their heads, reading them. She wanted to see how hard Brody Hoffman would work to deflect any guilt from himself. She sighed. "He doesn't seem to have a lot of friends. So I decided to talk to people like you, people who filed complaints against JHG, people who might be able to tell me more about Jason Geiger."
"He's ruthless. Does that help you?"
He glanced at the clock.
"Listen, I can't help you."
"You can't or you won't?"
"Maybe both. I haven't seen that man since I completed his shopping center in Roseville. I don't know where he is or what he does in his free time. I never once saw or met his wife, Lacey."
He came to his feet.
"I'm going to have to ask you to leave."
She sighed. "Do you mind if I use your restroom?" Frowning, he gestured to the hallway close to the front door.
Have at it.
Jessie tucked her pad into her purse. There was a bedroom next to the bathroom. Glancing over her shoulder to make sure he wasn't watching her, she quickly poked her head inside the room. The bed had not been made. A pile of clothes filled an armchair in the corner of the room. The top of the dresser was packed with knickknacks. The closet doors were closed. Heavy footfalls prompted her to hurry back the way she came. As quietly as possible, she shut the bathroom door, flushed the toilet, and washed her hands. When she came out of the bathroom, he was standing a foot away, his arms crossed. He followed her to the entryway and held the door open for her, closing it behind her before she had a chance to thank him for his time. Gravel crunched beneath her shoes as she walked to the car. The air was chilly, prompting her to pull her sweater up close to her ears. Brody Hoffman, she decided, seemed a bit off but not exactly unstable. He was definitely bitter about his interaction with Jason Geiger. But who wouldn't be? A cat meowed. She spotted the animal huddled beneath a beat-up car with a broken window and a flat tire. Once she was inside her car, she used the navigator to log in the address to an apartment building on Florin Road. Number two on the list was Ashton Greer. When Jason first started his business, Ashton was Jason's mentor and partner. After the first 5 years, JHG Properties took off. The money was pouring in, and Jason fired Ashton unexpectedly and without notice, cutting him out of a promised cut of 25% of the company. Ashton sued Jason. Jason hired a team of experienced lawyers and won. 40 minutes later, Jesse knocked on the apartment door, hoping to find Ashton at home. The building was small and quaint, with only 7 units as far as she could tell.
"Who is it?"
a woman asked from inside without opening the door. Jessie introduced herself, told her why she was there. The woman who opened the door had a friendly face. She was short, with hunched shoulders. She smiled and offered Jessie her hand.
"I'm Wendy, Ashton's wife. Did you say Jason Geiger was missing?"
"Yes."
"Come inside."
The apartment was small but tidy. "Is Ashton at home?" Jessie asked.
"Oh, no, he's working."
"What does he do?"
"He's a teacher at Florin High School. The kids love him."
She waved Jessie into the kitchen.
"What can I get you?"
"I'm fine, thanks." Jessie followed her into the living room and took a seat as instructed.
"So, what can I do for you?
I'm not sure why you're here, but do you think something bad might have happened to Jason?" Jessie explained the situation, beginning with her search for Lacey and ending with the fact that nobody had seen Jason or Lacey in more than a week.
"So why come here to see Ashton?"
Wendy asked, clearly perplexed. "We haven't seen Jason in years." "I talked to Jason's parents and the manager at JHG, Greg Fisher." She laughed.
"Is Greg still working there?"
"He is," Jessie said. "Nobody has any idea where the Geigers might have gone. So I made a list of anyone who might hold a grudge against Jason, and..." Wendy reached for the paper.
"Can I see that?"
Jessie obliged. Wendy chuckled as she looked over the names.
"It's worse than I thought. If someone was going to do away with Jason, I don't think they would drag his wife into it. Do you?"
"It depends on how angry they were," Jessie said. "Life is often stranger than fiction." Wendy handed the list back to Jessie.
"If Ashton wanted that man dead, Jason Geiger would have gone missing years ago.
From everything I've read about Jason, the articles and interviews he did when he was first starting out, I sensed he was closest to Ashton. I was hoping your husband might be able to tell me more about Jason when they first met. For instance, was he always so ruthless?"
"I don't think so. In my opinion, Jason Geiger made too much money too fast, and it went to his head.
Ego can be a real bitch. Money, too.
It gave him power, and he didn't know how to handle it. Jason became suspicious of people. He thought everyone was trying to rip him off."
She rubbed her shoulder as if it pained her.
"It's that simple, really. After Jason let Ashton go and refused to pay him what he owed, Ashton felt he had no choice but to take him to court. Unfortunately, it was a verbal agreement between the two men, and it only took a few hours for the jury to decide on Jason's behalf.
So Jason literally transformed because of greed?
She nodded. I think so. If you ever get to meet Jason Geiger,
a thrill, I'm telling you, you'll see a great con artist in action.
He lies, cheats, and fools people into thinking that if they work for him, they'll be making the deal of the century, when in fact, Jason is the one who'll be raking in the money. He's good at taking advantage of other people's weaknesses. That man does not have a conscience.
When Jesse left the apartment, she felt confident that Wendy and Ashton Greer knew nothing of Jason's whereabouts, and therefore crossed their names off the list. By the end of the day, Jesse had talked to 5 people who had all been screwed over royally by Jason Geiger. Not one of them had any clue where Jason and Lacey might have gone. Most of them didn't care. Tomorrow, she decided, she would change the direction of her investigation, since she was getting nowhere fast. The notion that one of Jason's many enemies might have kidnapped him and his wife or harmed them in any way was a bit over the top, but it had been worth a shot. It was time to talk to Jason's girlfriend, Shia Cohen. The problem was, Shia was married. That wouldn't be too big of a deal if she wasn't married to an officer at the Sacramento PD. She needed to tread lightly. 38. Colin entered the medical examiner's lab and talked to the woman at the front desk. He was here to talk to Brenda Parsons about the Willis case. Since it was going to take another day or two, at least, to get a warrant to search Peyton White's home, he figured he'd make good use of his time. Wren would be spending the day visiting local hardware stores to watch video footage and see if any person of interest had recently purchased rope.
Brenda's waiting for you, the woman said. Go right in.
He didn't need to be told where to go. He and Brenda had been working together for years. He entered the room at the end of the hallway. The unpleasant smell of a refrigerated yet decomposed body greeted him. After the first wave passed by, he was fine. Brenda smiled and pointed at the gloves by the door.
Glad you made it. I want to show you something.
He put on shoe and hair coverings and slipped on disposable gloves as he crossed the room to where she stood next to the corpse lying on the steel table in the center of the room. Using a tongue depressor, she pointed out 2 distinct marks that looked like circles, slightly larger than a quarter, both close to the Adam's apple and partially overlapping the distorted and purplish-red ring made by the rope from which he'd hung.
What are those?
Colin asked.
Thumbprints. This is the first time since I've been practicing that I was able to develop prints from a dead body.
He perked up.
How is that possible?
It rarely is.
Humidity is often a factor when it comes to using techniques required to process fingerprints from the skin. In this case, though, I believe it was the rope that helped protect the prints while moving the body. The rope was left in place until the body was taken from the bag. Once the rope was removed, and because I knew you wanted the case handled as a homicide, I used cyanoacrylate, also known as superglue, she said. After the glue was heated to vapor form, it affixed to the residue of the fingerprint. I was able to get photographs, but the bad news is that these prints are not reliable.
And the good news?
Someone strangled Roger Willis, Brenda said matter-of-factly. And whoever did it staged the scene to make it look like suicide. In my opinion, you're dealing with a homicide.
10 minutes later, back in his car, Colin sifted through pictures from the crime scene. Although he was keeping a close eye on the 3 people Sharon Willis had personally named, he wasn't ruling out the possibility of more names being added to the list of people he might want to talk to. Gretchen Sullivan, Peyton White, and Ben Morrison. He sat there and stared at the photo of Willis dangling slack-mouthed from the tree. The rope had been wrapped around the tree branch 3 times before it was knotted. He looked over the copy of the report Brenda Parsons had just given him. Roger Willis weighed 170 pounds. Gretchen Sullivan was a sturdy woman, to be sure. She had made it clear she didn't want Roger Willis anywhere near her child. But was she capable of strangling the man,
hauling him into her car and hanging him? She would have had to climb a tree with heavy rope in tow and have the strength to pull 170 pounds of dead weight high off the ground. No way. As far as he was concerned, Gretchen was not a suspect. But he would leave her on the list of persons of interest for now. She might not be strong enough to pick up Willis, but what was to stop her from getting help from a friend? And what about Peyton White? He worked many hours and had limited free time, but he and his family had spent time with Roger Willis on the weekends, away from the soccer field. Peyton White had trusted the soccer coach enough to have allowed his daughter to spend time at his house and a myriad of other places, including a trip to the theater for an afternoon of team bonding. The notion of having a trusted friend inappropriately touch his 11-year-old daughter would be a hard pill to swallow. Peyton White definitely had motive. He was also in good shape. Lifting a 170-pound man would be doable. Peyton had also shown his aggressive nature when he attacked Roger Willis in the parking lot in front of plenty of witnesses. Colin examined the close-up pictures of the thumbprints that looked like two round bruises. It wasn't easy to strangle a man with your bare hands, but Ben Morrison had proved himself quite capable of that when he saved Jesse and others from the heartless killer. Why hadn't Ben Morrison stopped before killing the man? He could have found a way to restrain the man as he waited for the police to arrive. But that was then, and this is now. Stick to the case at hand, he reminded himself. Ben had strangled a man before. There was no reason for Colin to think he wouldn't be capable of doing it again. Ben was a few years older than Peyton. Ben was also in pretty good shape. He had attacked Roger Willis on the soccer field in front of many witnesses. But did he have a motive for killing Roger Willis? Colin scratched the side of his face as he examined the close-up of the pants Roger Willis had been wearing. Both areas around the knees were stained with streaks of grass. And there was the vibrant white blossom found in Willis's hair. It was distinct. He would have to do a drive-by, see if Gretchen, Peyton, or Ben had the same shrub growing in their yards. Next were alibis. Gretchen had said she'd been asleep. She also had two children. Peyton had also said he was asleep, but he'd lied about his family being home. Ben Morrison had been out and about between 4 and 8, picking something up from work where he supposedly chatted with his boss. All worth checking out. 39. Jessie spent the morning sitting in her car, waiting for Shia Cohen's husband to leave for work so she could ring the doorbell and hopefully have a chance to chat with Shia in private. If she was having an affair with Jason, the odds were against her wanting to talk to Jesse. Maybe the woman had known that Jason was taking Lacey to dinner for their anniversary, so she followed them. Seeing the two of them together could have flipped a switch, prompting Shia to kill them both. Jealousy could be a very dangerous emotion. The front door opened at 9 o'clock. Officer Cohen walked out the door, jumped into his cruiser, and left the house. Before Jesse could get out of the car, the door opened again and Shia emerged. She was tall and slender, with long, wavy hair and a perfect hourglass shape. Jesse considered jumping out of the car and approaching Shia, but something niggled at her, stopping her from making a move. Where was the woman off to? Maybe Shia Cohen would lead Jesse straight to Jason Geiger. It wasn't long before Jesse merged onto the street behind Shia, careful to stay far enough back so as not to be seen. 35 minutes later, Jesse pulled into the Nordstrom parking lot at the Westfield Galleria Mall in Roseville and let out a groan. Unless Jason was hiding out in a dressing room inside, this wasn't the place she wanted to be right now. Just in case Shia and Jason had set up a place to rendezvous, Jesse followed Shia across the parking lot and inside the building. The department store had opened at 10 a.m., and they were having a big sale, which meant more people. Not a bad thing, since it meant Jesse might not stand out. As she watched the woman, it became clear right away that this wasn't about meeting up with Jason Geiger. This was about doing some serious shopping. While Shia tried on designer clothes, Jesse hung out in the lingerie department where she could keep an eye on the woman. If Jesse had known she would be going to the mall, she might have worn something other than sneakers, jeans, and a plaid button-down shirt. It was comfortable, but not exactly an outfit suited for high-end clothes shopping. "Can I help you?" Jesse looked at the employee and smiled. "No, thanks. I'm just browsing." She thought of Colin. Maybe she should surprise him. "We have a great sale on shapewear and loungewear today." "What about something a little more risque?" Jesse asked. "I've got just the thing." After the sales clerk ran off, Jesse turned back the other way. Damn. Shia was no longer in the same area where Jesse had last seen her. Jesse crossed the wide aisle between the two departments and walked through the area where Shia had just been. Another employee asked her if she needed help. Jesse politely turned her down and continued on. After a quick stroll through the other departments, she started back to the parking lot. Shia's car was still there. Go back inside the mall or wait in the car? She opted for the latter. An hour and a half later, Shia was putting her bags in the trunk of her car when Jesse approached her. "My name is Jesse Cole. I'm a private investigator, and I was told that you might know where I can find Jason Geiger."
"Who told you that?"
"I don't recall." Shia slid her Prada sunglasses down her nose so she could get a better look at Jesse. Her brown-eyed gaze roamed over her, starting at the top of Jesse's head and working its way down to her sneakers. Sunglasses back in place, she asked.
"Did you go to his house and knock on his door?"
"I did. Nobody has seen Jason or Lacey in over a week. The neighbor across the street is collecting their mail. I also went to his work. Same thing. Nobody has seen him." "I wouldn't bother you if it wasn't urgent that I locate him and his wife, Lacey." She didn't look concerned.
"What could possibly be so urgent?"
"Lacey's grandmother passed away and left her something."
"Oh,"
she said as she pushed the button that prompted the trunk to close automatically.
"I'm sure she'll be thrilled to find out whenever they return."
She left Jesse's side and opened her car door. Her grandmother died, Jesse thought, but didn't say. Most people would be saddened by the news, not thrilled. Regardless, Jesse closed the distance between them and pressed on. "Jason isn't answering his phone. Doesn't that worry you?"
"Why would it?"
"Damn." Jesse hadn't wanted to spell it out, but her hand was being forced. "I was told that you and Jason were spending time alone with each other. If there is any truth to that, if you care about him at all, I would think you might want to help me find him. I'm afraid Jason and Lacey could be in danger." Shia stiffened.
"In danger? Why?"
"Because Jason has pissed off a few people over the years." Jesse tilted her head in wonder. "Maybe someone's husband got wind of an affair. Or maybe you were upset after discovering that Jason was taking his wife out to dinner to celebrate their anniversary."
"Oh, please," she said in a bored drawl.
"Did you know Jason was taking his wife out last Friday night?" Shia glanced around as if to make sure nobody was close enough to hear what she was going to say.
"I don't think you realize how much trouble you could be in. Stalking me, accusing me of adultery. Jason and Lacey are my neighbors, nothing more. Now get away from me before I call the police and have you arrested."
Jesse watched her climb into her car, start the engine, and drive away. Shit. 40. Z hated hospitals. They smelled funny. Too many sick people. She stopped at the information desk in the lobby and asked the woman sitting there where she could find Penny Snyder's father, Nathaniel Snyder. After that, she went to the gift shop and bought him a cactus and a stuffed animal, a kitty with wiry whiskers and stripes. She checked in at the nurse's station, told them she was a good friend, and headed straight for his room. She had no idea it would be that easy. Nathaniel Snyder did not look well. There were tubes running from his arms to the machines behind the hospital bed. He also had tubes in his nose. His skin was yellow and his breathing was shallow. His eyes were closed. The machines beeped softly around him.
There were tubes running from his arms to machines. She had been reading up on the man, digging deep and using every database she could get her hands on to find information on him. She knew he once had loving parents who had died in a car crash when he turned 18. Leaving his two brothers with an aunt, he joined the army. When he returned home, he'd moved into an apartment with his youngest brother and cared for him until he died of AIDS. 2 years later, he'd lost his other brother to cancer. He'd gotten a job at a food market, and over the years he worked his way up from checker to produce manager and finally, head manager of the entire store. It was in the bakery where he'd met Arlene and fallen in love, madly in love. But sometimes love could be fleeting, or dangerous, or just plain fucked up. After his wife disappeared, Nathaniel's in-laws had testified that he'd beaten Arlene, and she'd been afraid for her life. Arlene had never reported domestic violence to the police. Neighbors never called 911. But it was the blood stain in the trunk that most believed was the reason Nathaniel was found guilty. Nathaniel stirred. Z set the cactus and the stuffed animal on the windowsill, then went to stand at the side of his bed. His eyes were still closed, but she decided to talk to him anyway. "I'm sorry to bother you, Mr. Snyder, but I'm trying to find Arlene Snyder, and I thought maybe, just maybe, you know more than you've been letting on." His finger twitched. "You were right. He knows something." His finger hardly moved. "Don't be stupid. If he knew where his wife was, he would have told the jury in the courtroom and saved himself all those years in the slammer." Ignoring the voices, Z said, "I work for a well-known private investigator, and this is my first missing persons case. I've been reading up on you. Does your daughter have any idea what an amazing man you are? You have sacrificed so much. Even before I started my research on you, I sort of knew you didn't do it. You know, kill your wife." All five fingers moved this time. He looked as if he was heavily medicated, but he could hear her. "Penny loves you very much. She found your love letters and pictures, and she thinks you're innocent too. She wants to find her mom and prove you didn't kill her." His head moved just enough to make Z think he was trying to shake his head no. "I just don't get it. You told everyone you didn't kill her, but why didn't you get on that stand and tell everyone what you knew?" Deafening silence. "I hope you don't die in this place. It smells. Get better so you can come home and let Penny take care of you, just as you took care of your brothers. Maybe then you could tell her the truth and tell me why you allowed